guns in America. Since the birth of a nation, in truth and folklore, the gun is deeply embedded in American culture. And most of us, even in Australia, are aware of the much-cited Second Amendment to the US Constitution, which reads, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Arguably a simple, basic amendment to protect the people from its government. But this right to bear arms has resulted in a country saturated with guns, where going to primary school, going to the shops, or even going to a gig may result in you being fatally shot by a fellow citizen. It is a country where the widespread adoption of stand-your-ground laws explicitly allow people to use guns as a first resort for self-defense in the face of a threat. It is a country of carnage, where, according to Gun Violence Archive, so far in 2022 alone, there have been over 18,000 gun violence deaths and over 230 mass shootings. And on May the 24th in Uvalde, Texas, a teenage gunman shot his grandmother, then armed with an automatic rifle and wearing body armor, stormed a local primary school, killing 19 children and two teachers. The shooter had legally purchased two automatic rifles and hundreds of rounds of ammunition at a local gun shop days before the massacre. It's astonishing to research this subject. It is gobsmacking to look at the stats and figures, the charts, graphs, and maps across the US showing gun usage and killings, including stats like gun violence is now the leading cause of death for American children, and that there are more guns than people, where almost every person lives in a household with a gun, that in 2020 alone, Americans purchased 17 million guns, and US gun manufacturers produced 11 million firearms. It is just astounding. It seems that in a society where Americans are in an arms race with themselves, the constitutional right to bear arms is a murderous feedback loop, that to feel safe from each other, you need a firearm, because everyone else has the same fear, and they also have firearms. But with most Americans keen for gun control measures, like background checks or a ban on military-grade weapons, their politicians seem reluctant for any change. Why? What is it about the US that gun law reform may never happen? Can the militia ever be well regulated? To discuss this, I'm joined by Dr. Emma Shortis, lecturer in the Social and Global Studies Center at RMIT University, whose recent article in The Conversation, "American Exceptionalism, the Poison That Cannot Protect Its Children from Violent Death," cogently examines US gun culture. It is an excellent read and a perfect piece on this issue. Welcome, Dr. Emma.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You are welcome. So you've spent time in the US, but you say in your essay, you've always been afraid of America. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, look, as somebody who has studied American history for a long time and spent a fair bit of time there, both as a child and as an adult, I almost kind of, you can't not be afraid of going to the United States. You know, it's demonstrably risky to go to places that I was going to, you know, college campuses, are dangerous places where mass shootings happen on a pretty regular basis. And, you know, the stats you outlined at the start just show, you know, how rife guns are in American society. And as, you know, somebody who's incredibly lucky to come from Australia, that is genuinely frightening. And, you know, when I had the opportunity to go back to the US with my daughter, it was something that I thought about really hard, because as you said, like it's a genuine risk that you have to factor in when you go to the United States.
Yeah, in your article you say you actually thought twice about going.
I did, yeah. I thought really hard about it, mostly because of my, you know, my baby that I was taking with me. But I didn't ever feel like I could kind of make that call, you know, based on gun culture, that I'd say I wasn't going to the US because of this, that, you know, that would be kind of, you know, lacking ambition and lacking bravery. So I didn't actually feel brave enough to say, no, I'm not going to that place. And of course, you know, I was fine. and my, I'm so lucky to say my baby was fine. Mm. But the fear never went away, you know, the whole time that I was there. And I'm sure other, you know, other Australians who go to the US kind of feel the same way. Like, you're very aware of guns just kind of being visible all the time, you know, especially in some states in the US, they're just kind of people walking around with guns, and that never stops being frightening, I don't think.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it would be like with people walking around with guns in public.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something you think about kind of all the time in normal life. Like, you know, when we went shopping at Walmart, like Walmart is the, you know, it's just like kind of going to a shopping center, but is the site of frequent mass shootings or supermarkets. Like there was a mass shooting in a supermarket just last week in the United States. But I think it's also really important to say that, you know, particularly as a kind of, as a privileged white person in the US, I was insulated from a lot of that danger. And I think what we shouldn't ever forget is how tied up American gun culture is with the kind of deeply racist history and present of the United States.
Yeah, I want to get to that. There's a moment you talk about in your article about a visceral moment where you were gutted by a couple of kids pretending to shoot a gun. Can you explain a bit more about that situation and why you felt so moved by that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I was so lucky to be at Yale University, which has amazing facilities, including this like really cool natural history museum that I used to take my daughter to all the time. And towards the end of our time there, we were there in the dinosaur hall, and my daughter was kind of, you know, playing, looking at the dinosaurs, and these two young boys were standing above a sort of a floor above the dinosaur hall, looking down on the dinosaur hall as I watched, pretended to cock a shotgun and then kind of pretended to shoot the people who were downstairs below him in the dinosaur hall, including my daughter. And, you know, it was such a small moment, but I just had such a visceral reaction to it because of what I knew about the United States, but also because, and I hadn't realized this before I got there, but Yale, New Haven, the town that Yale is in, is only about 25 miles from Sandy Hook, which is where that horrendous mass shooting had occurred, you know, only a few years before I was there. And the same year that I was there, there'd been the mass shooting as well at Parkland in Florida. And so to kind of see this, to see kids, you know, playing these games while their grandparents were standing near them, while it was such a small moment, you know, was so visceral. And I just kind of was so angry. I was so angry at that place and that people have to live with that fear, and don't want to. You know, people talk so often, every study, about how the majority of Americans want gun control, but their system, their political system, is so broken that it allows that to happen, you know, that it refuses to protect children like my daughter, you know, the same age as my daughter, in their schools. It just kind of defies all logic.
It does. It completely defies logic, and sometimes capitalism defies logic itself. Mm. But you just mentioned then that American institutions, it seems they're powerless to enact any gun reform, because Americans believe, and you sort of, you allude to this a lot in your article, consciously or not, that any sacrifice is worth it to live in the best country in the world. So this is an example of American exceptionalism, I would assume. Could you elaborate a little bit? What even is American exceptionalism?
Sure, it is a hard thing to explain, and I think most people have a kind of idea of what we mean by that, because every country has a little bit of it. You know, like our own new prime minister has spoken about, you know, Australia being the best country in the world, and that's kind of the idea behind, you know, that is exceptionalism. But it kind of operates a little bit differently in the United States, because since even before its founding, you know, many of the kind of founding members of the United States as a nation saw it as kind of ordained by God as this remarkable experiment in as a republic and in democracy. And so it was kind of set up from the start, I suppose, as this unique creation, this unique democratic creation. And what that has kind of created in the United States is this reverence, you know, for those so-called founding fathers, the Revolution and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which is what the Second Amendment is part of. And that reverence and that kind of deep-seated belief in the United States as the best place in the world, I would argue, especially amongst kind of a powerful elite, has led to this kind of sense of resignation around gun rights, because they're tied to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you know, as just kind of something that happens in America. And that even despite them, you know, you will see people say, you know, despite these horrendous, unthinkable things that happen, the United States is still the best place to live in the world. And that's tied to privilege and to power and to the racist history of the United States. And it's also tied to capitalism. So all of these things kind of work together to create this environment where the reform that's needed is really difficult to come by, you know, because of institutions, but also because of powerful people who are kind of imbued in this sense of the exceptionalism of their country and the exceptionalism of their own power. And so what that kind of creates is an unwillingness to do anything.
So it's difficult not to sound smug from an Australian perspective, but how is it though that Australia and New Zealand, our politicians, will enact laws to control guns, but the US can't ever seem to do it? You say in your article, the suffering Americans willingly inflict on each other, on their children, it's horrifying as it is mundane, defies all logic and compassion. And I guess you're just going back to what you're alluding to there. Why are they like this? I just don't understand. Why can't they change? What is it? Is it the gun control lobby? Is it just the apathy? I'm not sure. What is it, you think?
I think it's kind of all these things working together, you know, and it is really hard not to make the comparison between Australia, you know, that after the Port Arthur massacres, the Australian government enacted gun laws, same in New Zealand, same in Scotland, you know, so it is really hard not to make, or, you know, it's really, it's an obvious comparison. And I think, you know, I also see that it defies logic that the United States, powerful people in the United States kind of refuse to take this path. And it is a really hard question to answer because it's also kind of tangled up, I think, in that unique history of the United States, the way power operates in the United States, which is quite different to places like Australia and New Zealand. You know, we don't have perfect democracies, but we also don't have the same kind of voter suppression that happens in the United States, which means that, you know, even if a majority wants something and quite clearly demonstrates and says consistently that they want something like gun control, doesn't necessarily translate into political action. It's also about state capture. It's about the billions of dollars tied up in not just gun ownership, but everything that sits around that, including the military industrial complex. It's about the Supreme Court as well, which operates in a very different way to the way our courts operate and is increasingly conservative and anti-democratic. So this is about a broken political system. And so that's why kind of getting any action on guns is going to have to be tied to the need for much bigger reforms in the American political system and the way that it functions.
Are we underestimating the power of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, which you say in your article has the entire Republican Party and too many Democrats on its payroll? Could you tell us a bit about the NRA and the power that it wields?
Yeah, sure. It's funny because I think from the outside especially, you know, we tend to see the NRA as this kind of fixed part of American politics. The gun lobby is this kind of having huge power, but it wasn't always that way. The NRA didn't really emerge until the kind of 1970s and 1980s as the political force that we see it as today. They endorsed their first presidential candidate in 1980 in Ronald Reagan, and kind of have since then built up this just enormous political power where in some states you basically need an endorsement or a good rating by the NRA in order to have any chance of being elected, most importantly because of the fundraising, the money that comes with that. So we're talking about just eye-watering amounts of money and donations. Yeah, absolutely. And that's not even including the kind of the rest of the industry around, you know, security and policing as well, because this is deeply tied to huge policing budgets in the United States too. So, you know, this is about basically money influencing political power and entrenching political systems. You know, as I'm sure, you know, all of your listeners know, there was an NRA convention like a number of days after the last school shooting, and the power is so entrenched that, you know, they're not even too ashamed to hold these conventions, and senators from Texas aren't too ashamed to go and speak at the NRA. This is how deeply entrenched that power is. But it isn't inevitable. You know, it wasn't always like this, and it's not inevitable that it will stay like that.
One of the arguments we hear is, why don't we just arm the teachers? Why don't we just have more guns? That would solve the problem.
Yeah, and that's not a new argument. Like, it's so striking about how every time this happens, the conversation is the same. You know, the conversation is around, like, how people get access to schools, or that teachers need to be better armed, or that there needs to be more security in schools. And a lot of that is basically about kind of distorting the narrative or distracting people from that core question that you identify, which is about the ability of people to buy these guns. You know, guns in these massacres, including the ones in Sandy Hook, they were bought legally. And even though there were all kinds of red flags around the perpetrators, you know, they weren't stopped from buying guns because of these liberal gun laws in the United States that there's efforts even now to, you know, to loosen more. So this happens every time. But I think it's important as well to acknowledge that there is a huge movement against this, and that the conversation and the narrative has changed, especially since the Parkland massacre in Florida.
Yeah.
So there are grassroots movements to change this as well.
Yeah, there's definitely a move. A lot of people want to change it in the States. It's just that ability, that this disconnect between wanting to have it happen and it actually happening.
It's a broken political system, basically.
So you're saying system change is required there?
Look, I think so. You know, I think, as I said, this is about a democratic reform so that American democracy actually better reflects the will of the people and doesn't allow, you know, 27 words written by a bunch of white blokes 200 years ago to kind of dictate the safety, the very existence of American children. You know, the United States is the only place where this happens. And the fact that hasn't changed, you know, just continually defies belief. But again, it's not inevitable that it will stay this way.